from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Los Angeles Times book critic and former book editor David Yulin joins us for an hour of conversation all about reading and whether or not reading can still provide what it traditionally has given to serious and engaged readers in an increasingly speeded up digital age. Yulin calls our time a distracted time. We'll talk with him next, and we'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Literature is dead, David Yulin's ninth-grade son Noah announced to his book-loving, book-critic father, and that helped provide a catalyst for David Yulin to meditate on why reading matters in this digital age, which he calls a distracted time. The author of The Myth of Solid Ground, David Yulin is also former book editor of the Los Angeles Times. His newest book is The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time, and he joins us for this Forum Hour. And good morning, David Yulin.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Okay. Good to have you with us here this morning. And I guess a place to begin is sort of thinking about the last hour we did on Forum, which you probably didn't have occasion to hear, but we were talking about the whole flap over Facebook and privacy, and just also treading upon how this virtual world that we live in has changed everything and speeded everything up. And I think that's really one of the points that you make here. In a digital age, engagement, and particularly engagement in reading, which matters a lot to a lot of us, is more and more difficult.
Well, I think the impetus of the digital age is to react rather than to respond. And I think that that's a subtle but a key difference. You know, we're so hyped on the speed of the conversation and making sure that we're taking part in the conversation in the right moment and coming back with something to an event or a piece of writing or whatever that has spurred us, that I think we just sort of overlook the need for reflection. Sometimes it takes time to figure out what you think, and I worry about that.
So do I, and I concur that reading is a private act and a solitary act, and consequently it's very different than the virtual world where we can become interactive instantly and find out facts that we may want to glean, and there are a lot of distractions out there is really kind of the bottom line, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of distractions, increasing distractions, and sort of pulls on attention. I mean, sometimes even just in the interest of courtesy, you know, for instance, I'm sure you get hundreds of emails a day. I certainly do. I have to decide what I'm going to respond to, what I'm not going to respond to. That in and of itself takes some time, and then the responding takes time. And I feel that at the end of the day, often I have spent hours and hours accomplishing virtually nothing except sort of... Except virtually virtual things, exactly.
There's also a kind of generational gap that you get into right away here, and I wanted you to comment on that because I found it poignant in many ways. Here's your son, and you want to communicate to him the passion you have for books. You write about a litropolis, building your own litropolis vis-a-vis metropolis of books and all the bookshelves and bookstores that you go to and walking out of Europe with suitcases of books. Difficult thing to communicate and pass on. I mean, this is really what you wanted to as your own heritage to your son, because he's got all this digital world that he's part of.
Well, he's got the digital world that he's part of. It's been an interesting experience. Noah is not, as he sort of willingly admits, is not a reader by nature. He will read when it moves him, but it's not his filter on the world. And yet he's interested in books, but he's sort of, and in the world of books and authors and ideas, but interested in, I think, in more of an abstract way. He's very much a product of his moment. He's about to turn 16, and he is, you know, a digital kid. He reads the newspaper online. He, like most of his friends, is on the computer most of the time. And I think there is a kind of generational shift. I think you're seeing it in terms of the way that even kids who read are shifting over to reading on screens much more rather than on page.
it's something that we could despair of because, like you write early on about the delicate balance between craft and art in reading literature and how one gets at the heartbeat versus the explication of a work of literature. And these things are important to those of us who value literature. And I think the lesson here is that maybe there's a diminution in that value of literature, which is hurtful.
Well, I think there can be. I mean, I think there's a couple of things at work. Excuse me. One is this kind of speed and distraction. And I think that what literature, literature offers a bunch of things. And one of the key things which I write about is empathy. I think that Jane Smiley made the point in her book, 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, that if our leaders read more novels, and particularly novels from other parts of the world, that they might be less likely to engage in gratuitous military action. They might actually understand the cultures that they were dealing with from the inside, from a kind of emotional, personal level, rather than just as sort of the other. What literature does for us, I don't think it's just fiction, but literature does for us, is to sort of encourage us to imagine our way into other points of view, other experiences, other lives, and that can't help but enlarge us because it puts us into someone else's experience. So I think that's the first thing. But the second thing, going back to what you were saying, is that it by necessity slows us down because you have to get into the rhythm and the speed of the book. You have to give up your own rhythm and speed. And this sort of cliche of getting lost in a book is actually fairly accurate. Once you immerse in reading, you do get lost in a book. You get swept up in it. And I think that that's important in terms of a sort of aesthetic appreciation and also in terms of the empathy question. But I also think it's important as almost a kind of act of meditation, which in a high-speed culture like the one we live in now becomes even more essential in terms of centering us as individuals.
You write about the encroachment of the buzz.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always like, there's an E.M. Forster line that what novels do is offer a buzz of implication, right? They capture the buzz of implication of a moment in a way that history can't. They capture the individual buzz. And I feel like, so I'm sort of playing off that a little bit because I feel like now we're dealing with a completely different kind of buzz, which is the endless, ongoing, always intrusive buzz of what's happening next. And I think that that's another issue for me, certainly, and I'm very susceptible to this in terms of digital culture, is there's always that sense that if I'm not online or if I haven't checked my email in 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes or if I'm not on Twitter or Facebook, I'm missing something. But the real question is, what exactly are we missing? In most cases, we're missing a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing.
Talking to David Uhland, quoting Faulkner, his book is The Lost Art of Reading, actually quoting Faulkner, quoting Shakespeare, subtitle Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. And a lot of this has to do with just the act of reading, as you write about it, the silence and the quiet that's increasingly difficult to get because of this speed that seems to encompass or engulf us. In fact, I was thinking about how so much of it has to do with time and the way we use time. We used to hang clothes out on the line to dry, and then we had washing machines and dryers and everything changed, and now the internet has changed so much so that love of books becomes, almost a little dinosaurish for some.
Well, it's interesting about time because I think about a lot about the Founding Fathers. I write about Paine in this book, my great hero, but I think about someone like Franklin or Jefferson or Adams, who in an era where it took 10 days to travel from Boston to Philadelphia, right? Now you can do that on probably do it faster on a high-speed train because you don't have to deal with airport security, but you can do it in a couple of hours. You know, in an era where there was no electric light, these guys not only led lives as public figures, but wrote, invented, they were sort of active in a way. And I feel like sometimes I look at those guys and I think about my own life and I think, it's amazing. I have all these tools at my disposal and I can't be even remotely as productive as they are. Now, partly that's because they're geniuses and I'm not. But the other part of it has to do with this kind of the room they had to sort of immerse in one thing. You know, in a lot of ways for me, one of the enemies is multitasking. I have this argument with both my kids all the time. You know, I say, I don't multitask. I can't because I can't concentrate on more than one thing at a time.
But you're not reading and watching a ball game at the same time, David?
No, I'm waiting. My ball game doesn't start. I don't know which ball game starts, whether my ball game or your ball game starts earlier today. But I feel like there's a kind of that's something that we have that we lose, that the it's not even the quick response, although that's part of it, but it's the multiple things that we're all juggling at once, so that there is, it becomes much more difficult to immerse. That sort of deep concentration becomes much more difficult to access. And in fact, the trigger for the book was that I noticed about, you know, at some point, I'm not sure when, but I wrote an essay about this for the LA Times last year, and then the book grew out of that. But I noticed that I was having trouble, literal, you know, actual trouble sitting down at night to read, that I was, you know, having trouble getting into a book. I would read a couple of pages, I would put it down, I would get restless, and it was almost as if the kind of encroachment of the buzz, as, you know, you were referring to before, had a physical effect. It was physically unsettling.
Well, you mentioned, we've mentioned your son Noah, and you wanted really to get him to love The Great Gatsby by Scott Fitzgerald the way you did, and you gave him... Well, you wanted to work on six chapters had all good intentions, fatherly as well as mentor to your son, but found yourself drifting. I mean, as much as Fitzgerald can engage us with that lyrical and wonderful language of his, you had your own demons to fight here, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the situation was that my son was assigned to read The Great Gatsby for a ninth grade humanities class. He was having a lot of trouble getting into it because part of the classroom dynamic required annotation. He felt that it was sort of pulling him out of the book, that he wasn't able to immerse in the story because he had to keep pulling out to annotate. And it started me thinking about this, and I sort of offered to read Gatsby with him. He never quite accepted my offer, but I did it anyway. And, you know, it's a short book. I've read it a bunch of times before. It shouldn't have been a problem. But in the midst of my own distraction, I found it very difficult to sort of stay with it. I read the first six chapters, about the first two-thirds of the book, one afternoon. Then I was rebuffed in my efforts to engage and have a conversation with Noah about the book. And then the book sat on my night table for months, unfinished. And it became an interesting metaphor in a certain sense. I mean, it was real, but it also became an interesting sort of metaphor for this entire subject of reading and distraction and speed and slowness. And it literally took me, I think, 3-4 months to get to the point where I finished rereading the book.
Talking with David Ulan again, his book is The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. And he's a serious baseball fan. And we should mention today's game is with the Phillies and Giants at 1:19 p.m. Pacific time, since we mentioned that they are playing today. And
as someone who went to college and spent 4 years in Philadelphia with Phillies fans, I am rabidly rooting for the Giants.
That's good to hear, David. San Francisco and Bay Area fans are relieved to hear that. It may make the difference in today's game. Actually, you write about going to a game with your father. Mantle had a home run in the game, a Yankees game. You've been a Yankees fan for years, I know. I assume you're rooting for them against the Rangers. But there's a kind of fascinating take on what you remember of the game versus the facts. And that becomes sort of a metaphor for you, too, about the difference, what we can get out of, let's say, this digital age in the way of facts instantly, and what our memories may occlude or may distract us from in different ways, but nevertheless provide our emotions.
Right. Or even what the digital age or the kind of clarity, or I actually think of it as a sort of morality, in the worst sense of the word, of the digital age does to our interaction with memory. Because memory, as we all know, is a very fluid thing. And we build our personalities and our kind of psyches and, you know, if you want to use this word, our souls out of memory. We develop our own mythic structures. We develop our own narratives that make sense of the chaos of the universe, the chaos of our experience to us that allow us to sort of navigate the world. A lot of that, I think, has to do with the kind of intuitive or interpretive qualities of memory, where we remember things in a certain way, whether or not that's actually how they happen. And then those memories, the way that we build them, out of both a kind of combination of fact and imagination, become sort of psychic structures for us. I wrote about this in the earthquake book as well. You know, the first earthquake I remember having gone through was an earthquake that I remember taking place in San Francisco on Easter Sunday of 1980. But when I went back and began to research the book, there was no San Francisco earthquake on Easter Sunday of 1980. There were several earthquakes around there that it could have been, but clearly I had conflated a memory of an experience I had on that Sunday with the experience of that earthquake and had created some kind of psychic significance in that conflation that the two individual factual memories didn't have. Now, for me, one of the sort of exciting things, but also one of the dangers about the digital age is that you can literally fact check your memories. So in the instance of that mantle game, this is a first baseball game I ever went to as a kid, I can and have looked up a game report of that game, you know, box score, line score. I can, you know, it tells me what happened, you know, batter by batter, inning by inning, if I want to break it down that far. That's kind of interesting on the one hand. It's also probably more information than anyone needs. But the really fundamental thing about that memory to me is not anywhere in that score, which is the relationship of myself and my father, the experience of being there, the kind of attention I paid to that game because it mattered to me so much. The experience of being there was so exciting and enthralling that I remember it immensely vividly 40 plus years later. I don't know that in an age where every bit of experience or many bits of experience, many more bits of experience can be kind of digitally preserved that we necessarily remember in as fierce a way. And that worries me, not so much in terms of fact or fiction, but it worries me in terms of a kind of internal life of the spirit, let's say, which I think really requires that kind of imaginative transformation of experience.
Again, we're talking to David Ulan. His book is The Lost Art of Reading, and like yours truly, he is incapable of reading a book without a pen. Here's a quote from your book. You say, "We live in an era when everyone wants to tell his or her story, but there's no real sense of what story means anymore."
Right. I mean, I think we live, you know, we talk a lot about narrative, but I think we live in an era of narratives as opposed to an era of narrative. There is not really a kind of common narrative any longer. And I think that that's a complicated thing also. I mean, a lot of these issues are complicated. I think it's a sort of it has been an inevitable kind of social progression for me, you know, not for me personally because I wasn't born at the time, but for me in terms of looking back, probably beginning with the atomic age and the kind of fragmentation of certainty and progressing up through the 60s and 70s and to the present day. But I do worry about the fact about the kind of lack of a shared common purpose. You know, and one of the books I refer to repeatedly in this book and refer to repeatedly in my life is Common Sense by Mr. Paine. And I've taught that book many times. And one of the things that I talk about when I teach it is that it's a very interesting call to revolution because on the one hand, it's full of a lot of incendiary rhetoric. On the other hand, the program for revolution is very based on a kind of common interest, right? It's built around economics and security, right? Economic independence and responsibility for one's own security. Anyone on either side of the argument can get behind that. But what has happened is we live increasingly in a culture where we identify ourselves in terms of strict identity differences. Look at what's happening with the Tea Party stuff now, where you have candidates like Bennett in Utah, who was a conservative Republican who lost his primary because he had the temerity to actually cross the aisle and try and work with Democrats on certain issues. So that violates that narrative. There's no sense of a bigger kind of central cultural narrative into which all of these individual narratives somehow feed. We now just have parallel strands or are moving really in a direction, I think, of having parallel strands of narrative that never come together. And that's a matter for me of great both social, political, and literary concern.
Although when you mention Thomas Paine, of course, there's this frequent analogy. One hears it almost ad nauseum that pamphleteering for Thomas Paine is similar to what we see on the internet today.
I think it is. And I think actually, I mean, that's one of the I'm not anti-technological. And one of the refutations, I think, to the anti-technology people is that, you know, literature or thought or writing or, you know, have always sort of responded to technology. I do think that in some ways the the pamphlet culture of the revolutionary era was responding, you know, was operating on the technological cutting edge. Those pamphlets came out quickly. They disappeared quickly. They were printed cheaply. It was really the ability to print them cheaply and fast that made that culture so vibrant. And I think that Paine, you know, one of the great things about Paine as a writer, forget about him as a politician, as a political figure for the moment, is that he embraced that technological cutting edge in the interest of getting his work out to the broadest possible audience. And I think the same is, I mean, Gutenberg was a technological innovation. A lot of, you know, I have a friend who runs an independent press in Los Angeles now that produces fine art books. She does them on a computer. She's a one-woman shop, and she wouldn't be able to do what she does without technology. So I don't think technology is the enemy in any way. I think it's more how we deal with or integrate or fail to integrate technology that's the source of concern.
There's been a source of concern about literature enduring and will it last, and, you know, going back to after Ulysses was published, you write about dipping into Finnegan's Wake. I was reminded of something Sal Bellow said about Finnegan's Wake, that he's saving it for the nursing home, but you also making us aware of the fact that, you know, there's all this continuing debate about whether the novel has died and so forth. Recently, Jonathan Franzen was on this program, and he said he was taken by utter surprise at the success and marveled at the fact that there's still so many readers out there, so many people who, well, were ignited to, for whatever reason, read his new book, Freedom. And he sees this as a harbinger of maybe something much more positive.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. There was a study Well, there's been a study, a subsequent study, but there was a study in, I think, 2002 or 2004 that the NEA did called Reading at Risk, where they talked about the decline in literary reading in America. And they said something, 95 million Americans read a quote-unquote literary book in the prior year. Now, you know, percentage-wise, that's less than 50%. But I thought, no, 95 million, that's a lot of readers. So I think that and I also remember from my own sort of high school and college experience, you know, there's this sense, I think, or this kind of fantasy, I think, that we, you know, people at one point, there was a great golden age of reading. I don't think there ever was a great golden age of reading. When I was a kid and really beginning to obsessively read in the way that I talk about in the book.
David, forgive me. I have to jump in here because you and I both read Joey the Assassin as kids. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we were often drawn to as kids, you know, as
Absolutely.
Opposed to real literature, so-called. You know.
Sure. I read all that stuff. Chester Himes is
a quality writer, though. Yeah,
quality writer. Yes, but I mean, Cotton Comes to Harlem. A lot of those, you know, I read a lot of serial books, Doc Savage books, all of that. I mean, I think all reading is good, but I think that there's there's a way that reading sort of seeds further reading. But the other thing is, I think, you know, there are plenty of people reading, and I think there always have been people who didn't read. And I was one of the few of my friends in high school who was a really serious, devoted reader. Mostly, you know, my friends were playing lacrosse and chasing after girls and drinking illegally or things like that, or things that teenagers did. But they were not readers. And
lacrosse?
Lacrosse. I grew up.
Yeah, you were from a different class, I think.
Yeah. I was trying to be from a different class. That's a subject for a whole other conversation. But in any event, I think that, you know, they weren't reading on that level then, so there's no reason to expect that they would be reading now. I think reading is a very sort of individual thing, and I don't really lament or fear for the future existence of readers. I worry about kind of our cultural interaction with reading.
Well, let's find out if our listeners are worried about cultural interaction with reading, and has reading changed for you, and does it matter to you, and why does it matter? David Ulan with us, author of The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. If you'd like to join this conversation, you're cordially invited to do so. Our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free. You might even want to tell us what you like to read or what you particularly find more engaging in terms of your solitary reading. Toll free, you can join us now at 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with David Ulan, book critic for the Los Angeles Times. In his new book, The Lost Art of Reading, he explores the ongoing relevance of literature in an age of digital distraction. And we're going to go to your calls forthwith. First, let me read a couple of emails here. David, get some response from you from some of these. Here's somebody who says, well, I love your show, Michael, and appreciate the discussion. I take umbrage to the use by David of digital distraction. When studies show that the millennial generation, of which I'm a part, is the most literate in American history, and a generation we spend more time in the act of reading than our immediate predecessors, I can't help but think that this digital distraction is actually the gateway to a rebirth of a literary renaissance. If literature is dead, as David's son Noah described, it died during the height of the television era. The inherent democracy of the internet and the digital realm is the primordial soup of ideas from which new discourses and meaningful insights on life can arise, and from there people can begin to pick and choose those topics they wish to take offline to the worlds of books for deeper insight. Digital distraction is just a catchphrase and self-justification for those who can't keep up with the pace of life these days, and it's only getting faster.
Well, good. I think that there's a lot of merit to that argument in some ways, because I do think there is a primordial stew. But I think that eventually this the notion of taking it offline implies a kind of slowing down, sort of finding the things that interest you and figuring out how to engage with them in a kind of more slow and considered way. I'm not sure. I agree that the culture is getting faster. I'm not sure that there's anything we can do about that. I'm also not sure that it's the greatest thing in the world for sort of intellectual or emotional life.
Here's another listener, Alex, who says, why is there so much emphasis on reading? What about peoples with no written language? Are they bereft of culture or the ability to sustain complex thought? Isn't this conversation more about storytelling, that we are social animals and we like communicating? Just asking, he writes.
I think that's an excellent point. And actually, I think that the real discussion is about narrative and storytelling, because I think, as I think I touched on in the first segment, what we need as human beings is a kind of relationship with narrative. I think we're hardwired for narrative. So reading is simply one form of one delivery system for narrative, an important one, I think, but not by any means the only one.
Yeah, you actually at one point in your book, and I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment, but you write about narrative in linear terms, how stories come to us in a linear fashion. And yet I couldn't help thinking about how many stories come to us, particularly in modern literature, in a non-linear fashion, beginning, you know, with Dujardin and going through Virginia Woolf and Joyce, and need I go on? I mean, these are non-linear storytellers.
Well, they're non-linear, and I talk a bit about that, but I think they also, first of all, they are operating with some kind of structure. Even the books that look the least structured, Finnegan's Wake is an example. I think in the book I talk about Tristram Shandy.
You do,
And a couple of others. Those books look chaotic in some way, but they are structured. They're structured in a way that is not necessarily traditionally linear, but there is a structure. And I think the other key thing is that it has to do with how a story unfolds through time. Whether that story is linear, whether that story is alinear, it still has to unfold through time or through a series of different times, one being the actual chronological time it takes to read it, or if you're not dealing with a literary story, engage with it, a film, a video game, whatever. And also, I think each one of those stories has within it its own internal sense of time. And so for me, the key question in terms of linearity, let's say, or narrative, has to do with how that story, how that meaning unfolds across time.
We have such literate listeners that one of a caller called in and said that you quoted Forrester as saying the hum and buzz of implication, and this caller claims it was actually Lionel Trilling.
Interesting. I think it might have been Trilling quoting Forrester, but I'll have to go home and check.
Well, that's what you can do quickly in this digital age, right?
That's right.
We can find out immediately. Let's go to our calls. Polly, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is a wonderful topic. I'm a rabid reader. And I do a lot of internet reading, but I read the way internet people are reputed to do. I've become a kind of a scanner. But in terms of reading, I really have the opinion that it's about the example that is set. A really profound experience I had when I was a kid is my parents became a two-car family, I think in the late 50s. And in spite of the fact that there were now two cars, my father continued to take the bus to work. He had his own company, and it was a long bus ride all the way across town. And he did it because he said it was the only time he had to read. And I remember he read Samuel Pepys' diary, and he read Wind in the Willows. I remember him talking about those at dinner. And I think, I didn't realize how profound that was, of course, at the time, but I've told so many people that story, and it's led me to believe that, you know, I think if your parents just watch television and operate on the internet and read crap, that may be where your habits are set.
Yeah,
what do you think?
I certainly agree with the fact that your habits are often set by your parents, although with Noah it didn't quite work that way, did it, David?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of different things. I think your habits get set in different ways. You know, I grew up in a house where my father was a big reader, my brother not a big reader. And I think that in some ways habits can get set both in sort of in sync with the examples that are set or sometimes in reaction to the examples that are set. And so for my brother and I would hazard in some way with Noah, you know, his mother's a librarian, there are thousands of books in the house, that it's a way of staking out a territory of your own. The other territory may be staked out or may feel staked out by someone else.
Well, in your case, as is true, I think, of many of us, it sort of had to do with the random nature of who you read and what time. I mean, reading Payne, reading Frank Conroy, you write about the influence of Vonnegut. I mean, you begin to kind of take shape by the writers that you read who expand your empathy. And I think you also emphasize something very important in this book, as far as I'm concerned, and that is that reading is a collaborative act, that you're always working with the text or with the writer to essentially find meaning and to interpret and to imagine.
Right. I mean, as I say in the book, Vonnegut once said that it's literature is the only art form where the audience performs the score. And I've always liked that idea because it is the stuff, the writing or the books that I like or that I respond to the most profoundly are those that have an openness or a kind of point of entry where I have to come in and fill in the gaps in some way. I mean, this is one of Hemingway's ideas, right, that you leave everything out that the reader already knows because they can provide that information themselves. And I think even in terms of sort of the most superficial stuff, you know, those Doc Savage books or whatever, I still had to imagine the way those characters looked. I had to imagine what those scenes looked like, those settings. You have to bring your imagination to bear.
And we'll bring more callers to bear. John, join us. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I am quite envious of those who do a lot of reading, and one of the reasons I don't is because it's very arduous for me to read. I don't read fast, and it's cumbersome. And I remember as a kid taking these speed reading classes that I never applied myself and never did any good. So is there anything as an adult one can do to try to improve your speed? I would read word for word, and that becomes very arduous, and it sometimes puts me to sleep.
Well, remember Evelyn Wood.
Yes.
Do you have some thoughts about the pace of reading, David?
Well, I don't. I mean, I do and I don't. You know, I don't. I actually have found that as I've gotten older, I read much more slowly, and I kind of enjoy that because I retain much more. I think I talk in the book about when I was a kid, I used to read really fast and pretty indiscriminately. And I know the books I read, but I don't, any book that I didn't return to at some point, I don't remember all that much about. Maybe it's because of having become a book critic and reading with a pen in my hand, but I find that reading more slowly has enabled me to immerse more and to kind of connect more. In some ways, I almost take the opposite. I think there's a real value to a slow.
I have to agree with you. You know, as my listeners know, I read a lot of books, and I must confess that reading fast is something I can't do. I find it impossible. Let me thank the caller. Here's a listener, Chris, who says, I find it very difficult to maintain any kind of attention to a story drawn out over hundreds of tedious pages. I read a lot of nonfiction because I can read only the parts I find interesting. If I read the first 50 pages of a novel, I do not get much of a benefit because the story only makes sense in its totality. If I read the first 50 pages of, say, a history of Potsdam, I get at least part of the history. Men, I think, want this kind of information in their reading rather than what English professors want us to get from literature.
That's interesting. I mean, that's actually precisely why I like novels. And in some way, to go back to Franzen, that was one of the things I really admired about Freedom was the way that over the 560 whatever pages of that book, the story and the characters kept changing so that what I thought I knew on page 50 or page 100 or page 200 became something much different by page 350 or 450. To me, again, this has to do with that notion of narrative existing in time and giving yourself over to the narrative and to the development of the narrative. I think that we live in a culture where we want to know everything right now, and I think it's to our detriment. And
it also has to do with the joy of surprise, and I think you kind of touch upon this. We recently did an interview with Michael Cunningham, the author of By Nightfall, who also wrote The Hours, and the ending of that novel came as a surprise, certainly to me as a reader and to him as a writer, which is one of the things that, you know, made it, well, so engaging.
Well, and I think that that's part of it. I think there is that sense, too, that writers know what they're writing. But they don't often know what they're—I mean, they know sort of in a big sense what they're writing, but there is a real process of discovery or surprise, or can be, in the process of creating a work. And I think that that's the kind of—when you know—when you can almost sense when a writer's walking that tightrope, when they're kind of writing, as Didion says, writing to find out what they think.
Yeah, she writes about going into a tunnel and not knowing really what's in there, and it's dark, and then suddenly there's a light over here, and then there's a light over there, and that's really kind of one of the best descriptions of the process— contemporary writers that I know of. Here are some more emails that I'm going to go to before I go to more of your calls. Timothy writes, David, so good to hear your voice. I have many similarities with you, including a son named Noah. And I was the lacrosse kid chasing girls who didn't really start being able to read until I flunked out of my first college. Thank you and Michael for this talk. Another listener writes, recently I met the filmmaker Werner Herzog. His one piece of advice for young filmmakers is read, 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 read. According to Herzog, the only way to become a great filmmaker is to read. I found this to be an encouraging and interesting idea. It certainly motivates me as an aspiring filmmaker to read more. And here's Emily joining us. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm a recent college graduate, and one thing that I'm really struggling with is trying to keep up a reading practice outside of an academic setting. And one genre that I've really been drawn to are the new short shorts or the microfictions of, you know, people like Lydia Davis. And I have been, you know, really enjoying this new genre, but also kind of struggling with it or feeling a little guilty that, although I think it's really satisfying, I wonder if this is a reflection of our time or a reaction of our time that authors are creating extremely short stories to keep the attention spans of young people or older people. And I was wondering what you thought about that, if that's maybe a younger generational thing or something that's sort of sweeping reading audiences all over, that maybe the short story or even the short story is becoming more popular because of that.
Well, I think the short writing is becoming more popular because of time, and this book that I've written is very short also. Lydia Davis, by the way, is, I think, one of the most brilliant writers alive, and you know, deserves all of her due and much more. Everyone in the known universe should be reading Lydia Davis. But I think that what you're looking at is, I think reading is a broad country, let's say, where you can, if you want to read a long form novel, you can read a long form novel. If you respond better to a short, you can read a short, or you can move back and forth between them. And I think that to reflect back on what a previous caller or what a previous emailer, I guess, wrote about, I think the same is true of fiction and nonfiction. I'm a very Catholic reader. I read across the board, genre fiction, literary fiction, essays. I read about sports. I read about politics. I read short shorts and long books. I think the great thing about that universe of reading is that whatever sort of mood you're in or whatever your emotional state, there is a kind of reading that can speak to that, or a kind of writing that can speak to that. And you can have the reading experience you want. It's about the engagement. So the first thing has to do with you as a reader figuring out what is the work that you respond to that moves you, that somehow stirs you.
Well, to some extent, you touch upon the topics you just alluded to in your book. You cover politics and you cover sports, and all of that is really part of your own gestation as far as your reading habits and the importance of reading, which you highlight for us. I was also struck by something else that I just wanted to ask you about, and that is you write about meeting a lot of writers, and I've written about this too, meeting writers in the flesh as opposed to meeting them in the text, and sometimes never the twain shall meet. And even going to places like, where Malcolm Lowry was in Vancouver, mm-hmm. and where Jack Kerouac is in North Dakota, this kind of sense that we get from the work of the author and often imagining the author, it really doesn't necessarily in any way square with the author as a person.
Well, it's true. I mean, I think, the author exists, or many authors exist most fully on the page. And often what I found in interviewing them is that when I ask them about how that work came out or what their relationship to it is, they don't exactly know, or they can't exactly put it into words, because the process is somehow mysterious to them, and what comes out of that process is not necessarily what they thought they were doing when they started out. Some writers are very charming and effusive, some not so charming and effusive. Effusive. It doesn't particularly color the work, but what talking to them has taught me, the first and most obvious thing is that they're all just people like the rest of us, which, you know, should be obvious, but isn't when someone is a sort of idol or a role model kind of figure for you. But really that it is the work that matters, and that what's amazing about literature or any art form, I think, is that it, you know, something so beautiful can come out of such flawed vessels.
We'll go to more calls. Michael, join us. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
That's great. Great to hear this, Mike. And I can't believe that you're a slow reader with all the research and preparation you have to get for your show. Compared to me, I read at glacial speed. I just spent 3 months in Paris and a lot of time in Shakespearean Company on the Left Bank. And it was so wonderful to go up to the reading room and look across the river to the Notre Dame and have that quiet mind. I find reading a book and holding the book is a part of the tactile experience as a whole, opposed to reading digitally.
Or books on tape, right?
What's that?
Or books on tape. You prefer holding the book.
Yeah, I prefer to hold an old book, and it's part of the whole experience, you know? And I was a terrible reader when I was a child because I was semi-dyslexic in the 50s and 60s. They didn't know about that. They said, well, you're smart, but you don't try hard enough. And ironically, later in my teens, when the whole thing, part of the 60s, I read Orwell and Kerouac and all that, and Twain's Letters from the Earth and all that, I got into it. Point I wanted to make as far as famous writers, you might find this an interesting story. I went over to Berkeley to Cody's one day when Walter Mosley was giving a reading in one of his latest books. I like crime fiction. And I walked up to get a signed copy of Devil in a Blue Dress. And I said, have you ever read John Fante or heard of John Fante? And he said, no. And so I went to the store. I was in the store, and I bought a book of John Fante's, got back online, and I handed it to him, and I said, here, this is a gift from me to you. So you never know these people that you do revere. What they don't know is it makes...
Did Mosley's next novel show the influence of John Fante? That would be something to really be proud of, I guess. Michael...
Yeah. And one thing I want to say about you is thank you for someone like you, because you're really a proponent of reading, and you signify that the importance, and you give a lot to all of us. And I want to thank you for that. Kudos to you, Michael.
Thank you. And kudos to David Ulan, because we're of the same spirit along those lines. And let me get more of your calls on. And speaking of spirits, here's Diamond Dave. Famed bohemian poet of yesteryear.
Still on the planet, still talking to you. Hey, I have a line where I say, I'm never bored and never poor as long as I have my library card. I have a recommendation and a confession very quickly. Now, my recommendation is Elif Batuman's The Possessed, and the people who read them, Russian books, and the people who read them. And a confession. Last time I was on my call, we were talking to Jonathan Franzen, and I was asking about Brooklyn, and I realized after I finished it, I thought I was talking to Jonathan Lifen, and I was confusing the two. But Jonathan Lifen is Brooklyn, and a really good writer, and I think Franzen realized it, because he got a little huffy. I've never been to Brooklyn, he said, and I think he had a sense, at least in my guilt, I felt, he knows I'm talking about Jonathan Lifen, and they must have the two Jonathan must constantly be here.
Well, don't worry about it, Dave, because you and Franzen have the Minnesota connection. In fact, as I mentioned to Franzen on the air, Diamond Dave was a mentor to Bob Dylan, no less. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Drew. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. So I want to follow up on some of your conversation that David was mentioning about sort of the universe, how you find your way through the universe of books. I'd like some comment on that, but first to note that, you know, how you find the books, how you find the sources. For me, the New York Review is wonderful, and our local bookstores here in Berkeley are great. But I want to give a shout out for Forum, because this program, you know, Dave's book right now, or David's book right now, something I'm interested in. And, you know, thanks to, you know, getting the word out, I just finished three of David Mitchell's books after you had him on. I found him so interesting, and I get this such a stimulating conversation right through Cloud Atlas, you know, Ghost Rider and A Thousand Autumns. And Diane Ravitch's book on the death and life was another guest you had on. And by bringing these guests forward in interviews, they bring the books alive and make us want to get them. And I recently heard you speak here at Diesel Bookstore, and I picked up Spiritual Envy, and that's on the book list. So I'd like to, some comments on other sourcing and how you folks find the people that you're going to read.
David, you want to come in?
Well, I get a lot of, because I do this for a living, I now get hundreds of books in the mail, which is basically where I find stuff. When I was younger and not getting hundreds of books in the mail, I haunt bookstores, haunted bookstores. I still haunt them. And I looked at publications and read reviews and all of that. But really, for me, there was a lot of word of mouth, a lot of talking to friends of mine who read, a lot of recommendations back and forth, a lot of just hanging out in bookstores and perusing the shelves and looking for books that looked interesting. Because books are so expensive, it's probably easier to do that in secondhand bookstores, in as much as these things still exist. But San Francisco is still a good bookstore town, unlike most other cities in the country at this point. So I think part of it just has to do with a kind of random immersion. As a kid, I sort of pulled books off my parents' shelves because the titles looked interesting or the covers looked interesting, and maybe they stuck with me or maybe they didn't stick with me. There wasn't anything really programmatic about it. It was kind of like trying to map out a vast, unmapped territory. I think the real key is to figure out what speaks to you individually. Every critic, every reporter, everybody is speaking from their own subjective set of interests, the things that interest them. If they interest you, you may have found a kindred spirit, someone whose opinion is worth listening to. If they don't, someone who you may not want to pay that much attention to. But it really begins with your own sensibility and your own sense of connection to the kinds of writing that speak to you.
Well, also, since you use the word sensibility, there is, let's say, in you and in me, a passion for reading. And I think, it was developed fairly early on. I suspect, like me, from reading your book, you just wanted to absorb all these great writers. You wanted to become familiar with what they had to say. I mean, I knew names when I was young, Proust and Joyce and Mann, and, you know, I wanted to know who they were and what they had to say because they were important, and I knew they were important, and so I was drawn to their work for that reason, and then drawn even deeper into their work once I became acquainted with their work.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a big part of it, and I think that, again, seeing what, but a lot of ways I was introduced to those people by, you know, by my father, who was a big reader, by friends of mine who were readers, and, you know, by teachers, by librarians. I also went to a school where, you know, even as a young kid, they would let us take out anything we wanted. So, in third or fourth grade, I think I took War and Peace out of the school library. The school library knew there was no way I was reading that book. But rather than put up a barrier in my way and say, oh, no, you can't take that book out, it's not appropriate for your age group, she said, fine, take it. You know, I took it home for a week. I sort of had it sitting on my table or whatever. And then I brought it back, absolutely unread. But there was something about the kind of accessibility of that literature, the availability of it, even if I wasn't quite ready for it.
Here's a couple of web comments. Jennifer writes, my children are 7 and 9. They are both avid readers of paper books. Parents can still raise readers, but it takes discipline on the parents' part. Read to your babies and keep reading to them every day throughout their childhood. Give your toddlers books to play with in the stroller and in the car. Don't have a TV in the car and avoid video games at home. Kids will turn to books if the TV and video games are not an option. Children want to be close to their parents, and books are a beautiful way to spend time together. And Bobby writes, listening to you and your guest, I cannot help to hear a repeated and routine conceit within your program that being someone who relishes books above apparently all else is far superior in intellect. I have an undergraduate and MBA from Duke University. My intellect is not deficient because I read and listen to multiple sources, gathering relevant information, not including Facebook or Twitter, of which I do not participate. And I think we've just been charged with being elitist by this particular web commenter, and I don't know. I maybe plead quasi-guilty to that. How about you, David?
I'll plead quasi-guilty also. I should say I do not have an issue with technology or even technological reading, and I'm very excited about, in many ways, about ebook technologies for a couple reasons, because I think that they make literature accessible more broadly, which is always a good thing. I don't really care how you read. I just care that you read. I also think that ebooks will teach people, if they don't already know, how to read long form on screen. And that's always been the great knock about sort of the intersection of computers and writing, that people won't read long form on screen, that they read in a way, I think, that a previous caller referred to as sort of, you know, that internet way of sort of drifting over the surfaces. I think people will read long form on screen. I think the success of ebooks and the fact that this year really does seem to be the tipping point year where ebooks really did take hold illustrates that. So I think as we move into the future, there are all sorts of parallel streams of information, all of them equally valid and accessible. The key element is, again, the engagement.
Well, we've got a lot of emails and a lot of your calls, and we won't have time to get to them. But here's one just dovetailing on what David just said. I love to read on my iPhone and iPad. Instead of buying paper books, I just download what I want to read. It's an elegant and efficient way to read. I'm easily reading four times the amount I used to because of the digital format. If I have time waiting in line somewhere or picking up the kids from school, I just read from my iPhone, which automatically syncs to my iPad. I just finished Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, which I could not put down. It reminds me when I was a kid and walked around with a book. Also, when friends recommend books, I immediately download before it escapes my memory, as it has in the past when I would have to get myself to a bookstore. There are a lot of free classics I have been meaning to read, which are immediately accessed online. I think it's the future of reading. We also save resources, paper, shipping. Eventually, I would like to see the price of books decrease as more people choose this option. Well, there's a hopeful note.
Yeah, and I think it's a very good point.
And I appreciate the hour that we've spent with you. It's been delightful, and it's certainly been illuminating. And yes, we both champion reading and hope you will read more. It is a lost art, but maybe not too lost. Thank you, David Ulan, for being with us.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. Again, David L. Ulan, for many years, a book reviewer with the Los Angeles Times and book editor, in fact, for many years as well, and still is a book reviewer. You can join us here Monday through Friday. We're here with you 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We always remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.